Hello and welcome to Microphone Gain. Microphone Gain is a project of the Game Arts International Network. I'm Jim Monroe. This episode features interviews with Chad Toprak and Wiley Wiggins, two game arts curators and organizers from Australia and the US. I interviewed them about their game selection process for a research project Gain did in partnership with Ontario Creates and the Canada Media Fund. The challenge it was addressing is this. There are a dizzying array of in-person events, festivals, and conferences a game creator can attend internationally. Game Planner is a new resource intended to help game creators plan their exhibition and networking strategy based on in-person interviews and surveys from over 50 creators across Canada. Game Planner is available as a downloadable PDF in the resources section of the GameArtsInternational.network website, and we hope you and your communities find it useful.
So my name is Chad Toprak. I am the director of Free Play. Free Play is Australia's longest running independent games festival. I'm also one half of the curatorial collective Hover Garden and the curator of the Contours exhibition. So as far as game selection goes, I am mostly responsible for the selection of the games showcase that we have at Free Play, which consists of usually around 20 games being selected, and their respective developers offered to come along and be present at the exhibition. So they'll have a booth, and it'll usually be, so the festival itself is usually around 6 days, but two of those are our main event days. It's when our conference happens, and we usually have the showcase alongside the conference.
Okay. And go ahead.
And we also have the Free Play Awards, and we have a showcase of those awards as well. The selection for that is quite different. We have a whole judging process for that, and it's an open submission. It's free, but usually only open to Australian game developers, although that might change in the future.
Right. Cool. So with the, say, if we're starting with the showcase, you mentioned that they get the booth space, they get the, that sort of, place to sort of, show their game off. Is there, how do these games, come to your attention?
So we do a call out for games, and we tend to get a huge variety of stuff submitted from, fairly commercial projects to very intimate and personal or even political games, a mix of digital stuff, physical stuff, some custom hardware often gets submitted. And it's really up to us as to what we want to be showcasing and what we want the Free Play showcase to represent. And often it's a mix of it's a balance of some of the coolest and most exciting things coming out of the region, mixed alongside some of the most emerging artists and developers. And it'll often be a mixed bag of like really weird experimental stuff and a lot of personal projects as well. We tend to have a lot of student projects there as well. It's a great opportunity for up and coming developers to start getting involved and things like that. Yeah.
And so the call out, is it open to international game makers, or is it just Australia? Or
so historically, it's been I'm fairly sure it's always been Australia, although we have had, I think, one or two festivals with international games with them, and I'm not sure how that was handled. It might have just been that the developers sent through a build and we just had it there for them.
Okay, so yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about this selection process for the showcase specifically, you know, if mm-hmm, it's, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, one thing I forgot to mention is Free Play will always have an after party, and so far it's always been hosted by Hover Garden. And with Hover Garden, we also, it's actually not a submission process actually. So maybe that doesn't fall under this particular podcast.
No, this is interesting too, because it's more of a curation model I'm gathering, or.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. So yeah. So for our Hover Garden, after party, we'll often have a curated selection of games as well. Which Andrew Brophy, my other half of Hover Garden, and I tend to curate.
Cool. And so, yeah, maybe you just want to talk a little bit about, like, what are the things that you're trying to, like, what's your decision-making process with the curation and then with the showcase?
Sure. So mm-hmm. with the showcase, so... A lot of the exhibitions and showcases and events that I've historically put together have always been curated by myself and any other co-curators. And I've noticed that in the community, there's actually a desire for developers to kind of submit their things and showcase it at events. And often a large majority of those games tend to not make it to the events that I curate, just because I have the desire to showcase particular types or tastes of games that mm-hmm. I think people should know about or should be playing, etc. Mm-hmm. But through doing that, I've noticed that actually, you know, there are people out there who either I may not be aware of, or who are making work that, you know, may be outside of my tastes, but still may be quite relevant or interesting to the community. So that's why I think the Free Play Showcase plays a particularly important role.
Because it's maybe thinking more of the broader community rather than specifically your curational kind of aesthetic, or is that
exactly mm-hmm. yeah mm-hmm. So it's often quite a challenge, because we get like way more submissions than we have space to showcase.
Yes.
So
like how many more, like what kind of numbers are we talking, just so people have a sense of it?
Right So we often have something like 16 or 20 games to showcase, and mm-hmm. we'll often get anywhere between around the 70 to 90 mark.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow.
And that number tends to increase every year, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was asking about sort of some of the mistakes that people make when they how they're submitting or packaging their game, just in terms uh-huh. of like that sort of process, if it's something that people are missing or ways they're positioning it in a way that sort of doesn't help them.
Right. So I think what makes life easier for us when selecting games is for us to have a sense of what the game is and how it's played as quickly as possible, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So things like screenshots really help, animated GIFs or short videos to kind of explain how the game is played and what the game looks like really helps.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not all we look at either. We tend to look at, you know, who the developers are, you know, what the the makeup of the team is, because Free Play tends to put a lot of focus on diversity. It's always a priority for us to, you know, ensure that if there are any First Nation developers, that they have a priority.
So those are things that definitely make a game stand out, are those sort of some of those factors. Yeah.
Definitely. Absolutely. Absolutely. So historically, I think this is maybe like 2012, 2013, that sort of time. A lot of the games were possibly chosen over its, the amount of polish the game has.
Okay.
How good it looks, how good it plays.
Right.
I think we still have some of that, but we're definitely paying attention to many other things in the process. The makeup of the team is one example. Other examples would be whether the game engages with certain political or social issues. I think those games are quite interesting to Free Play, and we definitely want to be showing that sort of stuff.
Okay. And why is that in particular?
So one thing I've noticed is, particularly when I was making games as well, like these days I kind of don't really have time anymore just because I'm very busy directing and organizing events and festivals. But when I was making games between 2011 and 2015 or 16, I was making all these weird experimental stuff. Like, experimental is the only word I can kind of find to describe it. But the problem I was facing was that there was no local community to, or like local event to submit to for those games to be showcased. And so, you know, having experienced that, it's really important for me as the director of Free Play for these games that kind of lie at the fringes and the boundaries that don't quite fit in any other conferences, to actually have a home and a space to exist. I think that's super, super important.
Okay. And is it bringing those, like, sort of centering those fringe kind of works, how do you think it benefits the festival as a whole? Like,
I mean, Free Play has always been about the fringes. Like, you know, when it first began in 2004, it actually was a response to the state of the industry locally. And you know, the industry was very different back then. And a lot of the problems have since been solved. But, you know, there was... you know, a lot of sexism in the workplace. There were a lot of the companies, a lot of the studios were kind of siloed off, not really engaging with one another. Workers' rights were not great at all. And so Free Play was kind of a response to that and kind of began as a space for those conversations to take place. What they also did was kind of invite these fringe artists that were outside of the industry making weird new media art projects and game mods, etc., to come and showcase their games. So that's kind of the origins of Free Play. And as a result, it's always kind of paid attention to what's happened at the fringes. And I think that's very much at the core of what Free Play is and what it does, is to kind of spotlight and celebrate things that are happening at the boundaries of the medium.
Great. So yeah, and I mean, when it comes to, like, say moving on to the award process, what What's that look like?
So we have 9 or 10 categories that developers can submit to, which range from very traditional stuff like excellence and design and visual art and audio and narrative, etc., to things that I introduced when I became director. So we have the experimental games category and the micro games category, and we have a category dedicated to developers in New Zealand called Across the Ditch. And I actually kind of want to expand the award so that it encompasses not only New Zealand as our nearest neighbors, but also Southeast Asia. That's something that I'm kind of working towards right now. What I've done with the awards since I've become director is I always see the awards as this opportunity to kind of set the agenda and through the categories that we have. So if you have categories like excellence in visual art and excellence in design and audio, you're going to get games that cater to those categories. And prior to that, we didn't have an experimental games or a micro games category. And I felt like, you know, Melbourne has a lot of that happening locally, but Melbourne is a huge city and it's kind of quite fractured now. And there's, you know, divides between the more commercial and mainstream developers, which was once AAA, but has now since become indie. And now we have these weird fringe art game developers, which were once indie, but have since moved on from that space since that space has been co-opted. And so I think as a result, the awards categories... Further out. Keep pushing at the boundaries, keep experimenting. I think what's been happening is we're now kind of as we push further out, we're kind of starting to knock on the doors of neighboring art forms and neighboring disciplines. Like there's been a lot of cool things happening with games and theater, games and literature. There's actually, you know, this year's Free Play had a lot of writers present their games, and you know, these writers are not game developers per se, they're just writers, but they have decided to write interactive fiction using Twine or Bitsy, for example. And you know, in their own fields, they kind of don't have anywhere to submit those things, and so they come to Free Play, and Free Play is super open to that sort of approach.
Cool.
And but you know, a lot of the traditional categories like excellence in visual art and things like that may not cater to those very different sort of games. And so I feel like by introducing new categories that capture those sorts of games, you tend to draw new crowds and new types of games. And that's something that I've been trying to do over the last couple of years. And so I think it's kind of like not enough to just have an open call. I think it's really important to pay attention to what's being made and what you as the festival want to bring up and spotlight and celebrate.
Because there's this opportunity to kind of advocate for the types of games you want to see more of.
Exactly. From that regard, festivals like Free Play tend to have a huge influence over their respective communities, and even other conferences or festivals that happen in those cities. Free play is often like looked up upon and highly regarded as far as its curation goes. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed is that a lot of the time the types of games that we tend to highlight, particularly through the awards, has an effect and influence over the way people perceive games locally and the types of games that they then go on to make. Mm. For example, this year we had a Bitsy game called Novena end up winning one of the awards. And that game is beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. If you haven't played it, you should definitely check it out.
Cool.
It's quite poetic. And so that was one of the games that ended up winning an award. The developer of that game actually hosted a Bitsy workshop at the festival. Mm-hmm. That went on to kind of influence and inspire a huge group of developers who went on to make a bunch of more Bitsy games. And now there's like a cool micro Bitsy scene. It's really exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah. And it's like, I think back to my experiences at Indiecade, and I think it was 2009 or so when I had a game showcased there called Everybody Dies. And it's a text adventure video game with some images, but mostly like a, you know, old fashioned parser style text adventure. And I was sort of anticipating that there wouldn't be that the indie game makers who made graphical games wouldn't see it as a real game, or like, you know, I was surprised to be included in that group. But then, you know, the experience with my peers there showed me that, oh yeah, there's actually, they see the connections immediately in a way that maybe your average gamer wouldn't, because you know, they don't see, they just sort of see the surface of it. They don't see the kind of connections to sort of narrative sort of choices and kind of agency and stuff that you get in a text game that's similar to what you get in other games, right? So
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of interested, I mean, talking about this impact it has in the community and on, in terms of like encouraging certain types of games and giving people permission. I think sometimes with those tools like Bitsy, it's showing that the games community does take it seriously enough to give it an award. So there is a kind of permission that maybe, you know, a game creator might feel like, well, you know, I really should learn how to use Unity or to code in JavaScript or, you know, whatever, like to be a real game maker, right? Whereas in, you know, seeing these things celebrated gives people permission to work and to start developing their own aesthetic without necessarily having to, you know, sort of sink years of time into learning sort of coding skills in the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's amazing how much of an impact that has on non-game developers or non-games people who often tend to visit the festival as well. You know, they either see a game or attend a workshop and are inspired enough to kind of approach me and say, like, I had this, like, elderly lady who came and either attended one of our workshops or the conference or some aspect of the festival and said that she was so inspired that she was going to go home and start making games. And I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it, you know, like that's the thing that's, I think, a particular strength of these public facing arts festivals is that in this time of saturation where, you know, the existing indie games market as a commercial thing is getting super saturated, I think, like,
yep.
the the opportunity that these festivals have is actually to expand the audience and expand participation by the general public, you know, and that that will benefit that will benefit everyone, not to mention the sort of like help fight the sort of stigma of games being a certain like action based kind of like murder machines, you know, like that
Absolutely.
Kind of you know,
absolutely.
So, yeah. So I'm actually kind of a big fan of like thinking about public facing arts festivals as like almost like
definitely.
Audience.
We had an amazing opportunity for last year's free play. It was actually hosted at ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, which is one of the
institutions. Yeah.
One of the biggest institutions we have here that's engaging and championing games, and so as part of the festival, they asked if I would be interested in curating a re-installment of their Games Lab exhibition, which is part of their permanent exhibition Screen Worlds. And Games Lab was established in 2005 by Helen Stuckey. And as far as I'm aware, it hasn't gone through many reinstallments, maybe five or six since it was established. And I'm actually quite humbled and honored to have done one of those reinstallments. And have it as part of the festival. And it was, I decked it out with locally developed games, which I don't think ACME had done before. They had a mix of indie games and more mainstream titles. Like they had, what do they have? They had like Journey there, they had The Witness, they had Midhog. Mm-hmm. But then they also had like Mario Kart and Pro Evolution Soccer and Quake and Minecraft and other titles like that. But what's always been exciting for me is to curate locally developed games for the local public to play and understand that like these games are being made in this city.
There's
something really cool about that, and also something empowering, because a lot of the time in those public institutions like museums and galleries, you get, you know, groups of school kids who come through as part of like school excursions and things like that, and for them to see games that are being developed locally. You know, they may be games that they've played before, but hadn't realized that they were made in Australia.
That's right.
I think that has a huge and amazing potential, and particularly, you know, I also use this opportunity to show some of the more weirder experimental work that's going on. You know, we had the Catacombs of Solaris by Ian McClarty there, which is this weird, wild game. I love it. Like showcasing and exposing those games to the general public is always great. It's so different to what they're used to, which is, you know, mostly what they consume in you know, mainstream media.
Sure. My kind of take on it is generally that people, when they think of games, think of the action blockbuster games, and that's as weird as if, you know, you mentioned movies and all people thought about were the action blockbuster movies. Like people also think of the romances and the art house shows and the comedies.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, the other plethora of genres and different sort of approaches to the medium, right? So so I think this work is really important. I just wanted to kind of like briefly touch on, I mean, obviously that has lots of positive impact on the community and has like a kind of, you know, lots of, as I say, it's positive things that are happening. But What happens when you know, you get game developers that are in the community that like that aren't included in the showcases, that you know, that, I mean, is there have you had experience managing that kind of like, and discussing that kind of those types of feelings that come up of exclusion or of not being included?
That's a really tough one. We have had those moments. And surprisingly, a lot of the time it's two different scenarios. One is when you have a purely curated showcase or exhibition that isn't open to submission, and people want to submit their games, and you're like, oh, actually, this is a solely curated event, and it's not like an event that you can submit your games to, right? We had that when we first started Hover Garden back in 2013, and there was nothing like that at the time in our local game developer community. It wasn't something that people were used to, right? We had IGDA meetups and stuff where people could just bring their games and play test it, etc. There were like specifically play testing events that people would organize, and other developers would come and bring their games to. But we wanted to show some of the games that we felt the community should know about. And so we carefully selected and curated these games. And at our very first event, people were like, can we bring our games? Is this one of those events? And we it was quite a challenge to actually to try and explain that to people, that it's not, it's you don't just bring your artwork to a museum and hang your right. painting on the wall, right? It kind of doesn't work that way. So we had that initially, and eventually people kind of understood what that was about, but also once in a while you'd have someone who will try and push their game onto you and be like, hey, you should have this at the next event. And although I do appreciate people letting me know of their projects, like it's always great to know what's happening locally, what I don't appreciate is the entitlement that some people tend to have, which is this game is good and therefore it should be at your next event kind of thing. And that's really hard to handle. Like you can't directly push them away and say no and like shut them down. You have to kind of gently explain to them how curating events work and how certain games may fit or not fit.
It's all about the fit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it may not fit this year, but it might fit next year. And that's totally a thing that developers, I think, need to understand.
I mean, there's this larger cultural conversation that they benefit from, even though they don't have necessarily their game profiled in the way that they desire or whatever. The needs of the whole community and in context of the cultural thing, and sometimes that's like, I'm interested in knowing, like, do you have you made kind of any of this stuff like publicly available in terms of like your process of selection? Like you mentioned the sort of the particular interest you have in involving Indigenous creators. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. like and like do you is that something you are explicit about, or is just something you keep in mind as you are choosing and selecting?
So as far as I know, it's not publicly available. Like we don't have like a selection criteria that's public, but it's definitely something that we keep in mind and we often revisit And because Hover Garden is something that Andrew Murphy and I do together, we will come together and talk about what sort of games we want to be showing at each event. And I think we take each event individually on a case-by-case basis and get together and discuss like what this edition of Hover Garden will look like and feel like and what sort of games we want to be celebrating. And you know, you can kind of, over the course of the last few years, you can see certain trends and certain shifts, right? Like we used to have a huge emphasis on local multiplayer games at some point. And that's now kind of died down a bit. And we had a phase where we were showing more experiential stuff that perhaps like you kind of just walk around and experience things. And now we're putting a lot of focus and emphasis on locally developed games. That's something that we're now wanting to highlight more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's particularly interesting because excuse me. You have with the like the regional kind of local focus, you do two things. Like one is you show that games aren't just made in California or Japan, which is kind of like people's kind of go-to in their minds. But at two, you also kind of showcase the fact that these are very small teams, sometimes even one person. And it makes a stronger connection in people's minds of game creators as artists. So when they realize, oh, these are people who live in this community and access like some of the maybe the arts funding or like those types of things, like I think it's really, really interesting. Like we did a project in Toronto called Trontron, which was like arcade cabinet that had six locally produced games, and we would just have it in different bars and different galleries and things like that for people to play. Yep. And it would sort of surface that, just that sort of sense of like, hey, yeah, games are made here too by the dude down the block. You know, it's not just musicians and like writers and whatever. There's also game creators here. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Other things we've been doing. Going back to engaging with the public, this was something that we definitely wanted to do when we started Hover Garden back in 2013. And you know, back then we had no no connections with anyone who works at museums or galleries, so we had no access to those sorts of spaces and institutions. And so our way of engaging the public was to actually host our events in public, right? Like in city streets and in parks and gardens and laneways and stuff. That was our way of accessing, you know, people who are outside of the games community who may perceive games to be purely, you know, Grand Theft Auto or Battlefields or something. And we would find a space in the city. We'd have, you know, laptops and battery powered projectors with us, and then we'd find a spot and just beam onto a wall and start playing video games. And often, you know, people from the public would stop by and just either watch, which was totally okay with us. You know, I think that's it's a great way to engage people and get them curious. But often they'd, you know, either approach us and say like, hey, what's going on? Or they'd just like simply walk up and start playing. And I think those moments were just great and amazing.
Yeah. Directly interfacing with people and cool. Well, great. Well, thank you. I don't know if you had any final comments, but those were all the questions I had. So.
Just going back to the free play selection process and some of the grievances, I forgot to mention that we also sometimes have developers who have had their games showcased come back and resubmit their games again and have the hopes of being shown a second time, like back to back. And like, you know, sure, if the game has come a long way and it's kind of perhaps a completely new experience, we'd be open to that. But often people kind of just, again, it's a sense of entitlement that people see just purely as an opportunity to come and just showcase their game annually kind of thing, which, you know, considering we only have a limited number of
spots,
like we want to be showcasing as many new projects and raising new voices up as we can. And so that's also been quite challenging.
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty straightforward thing in terms of, like, you know, that people should be able to grasp just the idea of, like, the limited amount of spots. And I mean, if you were to expand it to, you know, 50 or 60 spots, then like it would dilute it in a way. Like, some of the power of it and the significance of it is that it is a selection, and it kind of cuts down, you know, kind of focuses people's attention. Like, I feel about these things, they're that it's not a condemnation of a certain game that they don't get in.
Absolutely.
It's like, it's got to do with, like, the fact that, you know, these in particular are ones that, you know, the particular curator or selection committee wants to make more discoverable, you know, like it has to do with those games being, you know, deemed kind of, you know, often because they're unusual, kind of given a kind of a special spotlight so that people think about games differently
exactly
see games in a different light. And, you know,
exactly.
And not every game does that. Even, like, beautifully crafted games that have traditional trappings might have really great deep gameplay, like that, that, you know, go on for you can play it for years and, you know, and really get a lot out of it. But it isn't the type of game that someone walking by at a showcase is going to glean any of that from. So there's certain games as well that aren't really great for showcasing as well. Complicated stuff.
Absolutely.
My name is Wiley Wiggins. I'm one of the co-founders and currently still for a little bit longer, one of the sitting board members of Huegos Rancheros, which is a indie games arts nonprofit in Austin, Texas. And by virtue of that, I've also been the creative director and for part of the time producer of Fantastic Arcade, which is an annual event here in Austin that Huegos puts on. So I've curated games for both of those. And then I guess in the past, I've also been an IGF judge for maybe like 3 or 4 years in a row. I did that.
Right.
So Huegos is being absorbed. The nonprofit entity is being dissolved and it's being absorbed into Museum of Human Achievement as a project, most likely. And so I'm going off to college this fall. At the age of 42, I'm going to get my undergrad degree. So I'm moving away. So I'll stay on as in an advisory capacity for Fantastic Arcade, the event, which we'll be skipping a year this year, and hopefully we'll be back at Alamo Drafthouse next year. We're going to have, I think, maybe just like a gallery kind of show party instead this October. It'll be a, you know, there won't be all the talks and tournaments and stuff probably.
Okay. Interesting. Wow. Lots of new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for the most part, like, this recording, I'm anticipating people listening to it who will be kind of curious about the seeing behind the curtain and hearing about the processes that, that game selectors go through. And just sort of, I know that there's, like, obviously there's going to be differences between all the things that say the Fantastic Arcade and the IGF and the Huegos Rancheros sort of So maybe just want to talk generally about the sort of differences between those three projects and in terms of like how games are selected.
Yeah, so for Fantastic Arcade's probably the best one to start with, because that's pretty varied. There's both submissions, open submissions, that would usually have started about now, about like mid-summer, and we'll get upwards of about maybe 200 submissions there, and we have a process for going through those. And then also we commission games every year. So we commission 5 to 10 new games, or games that already had a prototype, but that haven't been playable at a public event yet.
Okay, so like with when you say with those two, the difference. What would the process be for this, like those selections, like not the commissions, but the selections?
Right. So for the selections, it's pretty open. We've got a web form, where people are asked to provide a description, a playable build if one exists. The main thing that we want to see is a gameplay video for the first round. And that's, 5 to 10 minutes of just gameplay. Preferably not a thing that drives us crazy is if it ends up being a let's play with a, hey guys, what's up, gamers?
It's right.
your buddy, whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
That's already a big ding when we hear that. and then we usually what we'll do is we get as much assets as we can, like screenshots and stuff, in that first round. So if we do end up picking the game, we've got stuff ready to go for all our materials for online, the times that we've had a printed brochure that went with it. So we usually the first round of selections, all of the stakeholders get together in a room, we get some pizza, we get some beers, and we watch all of those gameplay videos. And we go through them pretty fast. Like it might sound disrespectful to say it's kind of a gong show situation, but it can be kind of a gong show situation because
sure.
After having done this for like 10 years, you recognize pretty quickly, like, people that are just submitting their game to every single event without any actual research into what the event is or what kind of games we usually program. Mm-hmm. So we weed that stuff out pretty quickly. So that's usually like, free to play mobile stuff that's just a clone of another game or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We earmark all of the stuff that looks like it might possibly fit in the same universe as our festival. And then we split it up into groups of people who are interested in doing plays. And then we circle back for another round once people have said, like, oh, this is interesting, like, I enjoyed playing with this. We look for multiplayer stuff. We like a lot of like local multiplayer stuff for tournaments, so we'll get together in another session and play those together. The stuff that we're looking for, it's kind of hard to define for Fantastic Arcade. We're looking for stuff that kind of covers a pretty big spectrum of weird or indie or artful games. So even if they're pretty conventional games, if there's something unique about them mechanically or stylistically, that's what we kind of look for. And it's funny, what works one year might not work another year, because a lot of times you'll see these kind of gold rushes to imitate a style that was, popular the year before. So it's always hard to describe to someone who hasn't like gone through the process with us every year, like what it is we're looking for. We're looking for things that are new and interesting and unique. Who made it usually comes more into play early on. When we're looking for to try and get better diversity in the folks that we put in our selections, when that usually comes into play is us going to people and trying to encourage them to submit stuff that maybe the kind of people that might not submit to game events. either people that we've picked up on their work, like, you know, online through social media, or people that are like maybe still students that are working on student projects. We try and stay connected enough outside of what gets submitted to us to like try and encourage different sorts of people to submit, so we get a better, more diverse kind of composed selection. But but once stuff gets submitted, we're pretty much just going by what we see in those gameplay videos.
Okay, and I mean, when is there an entry fee? Is it free?
Yeah, there's an entry fee. It's pretty cheap. I'm trying to remember what we charge. It's like $20 or something.
Okay, so a token, like pay for the pizza type thing.
Yeah, and we do. Yeah. The reason we charge is so we'll have tiers of selections. Mm-hmm. In the past, we had a highlighted group, and then there was kind of a general group, and the difference in that was, the highlighted group were people that we thought could get down to give talks.
Mm.
A lot of our resources go towards trying to get airfare for those people and get them situated if we can. Rarely could we ever pay for hospitality, but we get them, you know, food cards at the Alamo and stuff like that.
Right, right. That's partially what some of the entry fees go towards.
Yeah, yeah. And that kind of evolved from, oh, you know, these are this kind of like the first group of games with people that are going to come down and talk, and that evolved into we're actually like commissioning games that we build those arcade cabinets out of. It was always that kind of featured tier of games were always the ones that sort of fit in the arcade cabinets. And they it wasn't really a situation where I never wanted people to think like, oh, these are the best games out of this group. It was generally the games that like worked best in the arcade cabinets. We would get great games that would be like RPGs or something, and they wouldn't really necessarily fit into that arcade experience. And
the
physical arcade that we build is kind of a lot of what the event is about.
Net experience. Yeah. Like you have something that uses a mouse a lot. It's, you know, outside of a trackball and like anything that's any sort of, you know, kind of accuracy is required. It's just kind of a mess with a trackball. So, right. Yeah. What, when you mentioned stakeholders, so, on that layer, like what's the process that you involve people in that group?
So it's changed over the years. Huevos Rancheros wasn't the official curating board of Fantastic Arcade until really just maybe like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was more generalized. Like in the early days, it was because the festival actually started at Fantastic Fest, the movie festival, mm-hmm. as sort of like a special event there. So there were a bunch of people involved with that aren't necessarily involved anymore. And now that it's split off to become its own thing, it's the people picking games are pretty much just Huevos Rancheros. And then we have a couple of people. There's Josh Fields, who's the guy who's historically built all of the arcade cabinets. So we call him like our technical director. He's also involved in picking games. And then we have a committee that is like a volunteer committee of folks that either come from the Huevos Rancheros community, because we have these like monthly meetups, or in the last couple of years, Zach Traeger has also been involved in game selection. He's the principal person at Museum of Human Achievement. So we've like partnered up with them. So it's like Huevos Rancheros plus board members plus like four people.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Talk a little bit about the commissioning. Do people get a certain amount of money for that? Is that something that's like,
we pay to get those games built. It differs from year to year, depending on how many people we're commissioning, but it's usually like $2,000 to $3,000 if we can swing it. And then we also cover all the costs of building the cabinet and the controls that go into the cabinet up to like a certain price limit. If people want, you know, solid gold steering wheel, we usually swing that. And then the cabinets used back in the old days, the cabinets were like built into like old Pac-Man cabinets and stuff, and they get recycled every year. The last 4 or 5 years, I guess, the cabinets are like semi-permanent objects that then, in a perfect world, go into, you know, rotation at different arts events or at small businesses and stuff. Although a lot of them have kind of ended up in our storage space.
I know what that's like.
Yeah, we've got a space at Museum of Human Achievement that we're trying to turn into like a semi-permanent arcade space. That's part of the idea of joining up with them. So the hope is that like all of those games will, you know, be getting played regularly and getting serviced regularly.
Amazing. Yeah, that'd be cool. Okay, well, let's move on to sort of some of your IGF involvement and how it differs and what's your take on that process.
Yeah, IGF is interesting. It's been a couple of years since I've done it, but it's always a sort of like all hands on deck. If you've ever judged an IGF, please, for the love of God, judge IGF again. Like, there's a lot of games that need to get played, and it's hard to like spread eyeballs out evenly across those games. I feel like it's a very kind of organic process of like lots of people asking for eyeballs on stuff. The IGF, the site has been pretty good, I guess, in the last few years. Like, it'll alert you to stuff that needs to be played. Have you judged IGF
before? I have, yeah. I've judged and juried, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you know kind of what that's like. So yeah, you just try and play as many games as possible, and there's not really that same, you know, at Fantastic Arcade, we've got the luxury of like, you know, all of those gameplay videos where we can kind of like scrub through the gameplay videos and at least get a first pass done. But IGF, I feel like there's a lot of pressure on actually making sure you spend some time with those games, even if they seem completely like wrong.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know. I know a lot of like game developers have set up shit where they know whether anybody's played the game or not, and become incredibly resentful if nobody's played it. And it makes more sense too, because what's the entry fee for IGF? It's like kind of really expensive, isn't it?
I see what you mean. Yeah. So there's a sense of like higher stakes in some respect, as opposed to the thing that you were involved with founding and
there's like
shepherded, right?
There's a cash prize involved in IGF and all this stuff, and that we simply don't have. Our Fantastic Arcade is a completely different beast. Like, it's about a very kind of specific kind of artful, like art feeling of, you know, it's more like a gallery type thing. And the only reason you would want to be involved with it is because you know, your game kind of fits in with what's going on there. It's not, you know, you're not going to get a cash prize. Like, in the past, we'd like give people like a glass boot filled with beer as the grand prize.
Yes.
or stuff like that, you know.
I remember a lovely small little arcade cabinet that fit in your hand.
That's what
we got. Yeah,
I've been making those balsa wood arcade cabinet trophies for the last few years, but it's, you know, not doesn't mean somebody who's just blanket submitting their, you know, their mobile game clone to every single games festival in the world to get a balsa wood trophy.
yeah and I mean, I guess, like, I'm interested in knowing, I mean, you mentioned at some point that the you know, people were sending let's plays as example of gameplay, like as being a red flag for you. Where else? I mean, and on some level, it's like you understand, but it's just kind of irritating.
I wouldn't even call it a red flag. I mean, we certainly don't. Like, it's just kind of annoying. We turn the sound down.
Yes.
I think that stuff that is like deeply stereotypical genre conventions without subverting those conventions in some way, and this is how I judge for Fantastic Arcade. For IGF, I don't really do that. For IGF, I kind of really just I judge really broadly, right? Like, I'm looking for even a thing that's super conventional style wise that has really clever mechanics, I would totally consider an IGF, depending on what I'm judging for, like what category I'm judging for. For arcade, I need some kind of subversion of expectations or something new, or, you know.
Because I'm judging, it's the aesthetic. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm judging it more as an artwork than as a game than I do for IGF. But everybody, you know, all the judges at IGF judge stuff differently.
It's true. But I would say that there is a kind of like perceived audience of like where I think people vote more conservatively as like the game creators that are involved with judging, because they know that, or they sense that there's like, this is like especially in things like game design or that kind of category, where it's like, it's almost like, is this a game for game creators, like in the sense that like the cleverness, like it might look terrible or be very conventional, but have something very like under the hood that's very innovative or whatever, and that might not go well for like a public something that you're putting into public in a more general audience. But
like something like Baba Is You would totally burn up IGF and be huge, but like, you know, it might not, you know, if I show it to my 15-year-old nephew, he's probably not
gonna
touch it because it's visually simplistic. I definitely feel more, not so much like I gravitate towards that, but more that I need to judge every game on its own terms for IGF, because there's such a huge spectrum of different kinds of experiences. The strength of one game might not be the strength of another game. Like, there's so many different criteria, which is why it's probably important to kind of spend as much time as you can with stuff. And also, like, I think there's also a push at IGF, like I think it's really beneficial for people to actually give feedback, because there's so many games that are submitted, and so many of them like aren't gonna make it but might have something kind of special and interesting in them that should be developed. And I wish I could say that I've done that in the past with Fantastic Arcade submissions, but there's usually just hasn't been time, because I'm also producing the event and dealing with a million things. I've also, like, just in the last year, like, historically, I haven't even like written people to tell them that they haven't gotten in, and I felt really bad about that. Last year I fixed that. But it's always just been a staff time type thing. You know, there's like four people that are making Fantastic Arcade, and IGF is this huge behemoth of a thing.
Community effort. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I think that would help some people to hear, like, the realities of those types of like time crunch. The thing that falls to the wayside is the nice extras, like feedback on work and whatnot. I also think it's important for people to, when they do get feedback, to whether or not they accept it or internalize it or whatever, appreciate that was like extra work that didn't need to be done. That was basically volunteer labor on the sides of the person giving it to them. Yeah. You know, and if it is, you know, like, it might not be what you want to hear, but they did do it out of a general sense of support. You know, and that's the other thing that's hard about giving feedback sometimes, because, you know, even if you do have that capacity to do it, there is a sense of like, as soon as you get a kind of really angry letter in return two or three times, you're like, fuck this. you know, it kind of gets to a point of like,
yeah, you don't want to engage anymore.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but it's a kind of, it's not you, it's me kind of blanket statement is, but I applaud your effort to at least sort of close the loop with people to say that, you know, their work wasn't chosen or wasn't considered a fit for it, because it's, at least there is that. But I feel like that, I mean, in my own curation process, that is what I've chosen rather than any detailed feedback, because it's not you, it's me type of, because actually that's true as well, like the whatever the aesthetic of the thing is not the fault of the person, you know, sending in a work to it, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now, I mean, I think from the perspective of someone submitting their work, there's like, you know, they're like, oh, we have to do all these, like, put all these screenshots, all these sizes, and all these type of thing. But what you pointed out around, you know, just having all that stuff at hand so that when you're the very little time you do have to actually produce the show, it isn't spent chasing people down to help them out, basically.
It's hugely important. Like that's one part of the whole arcade thing that got streamlined pretty quickly was like, get those assets, like get those assets into the pipeline to go into the website and to be, you know, usable. And the sooner we do that, the better. And not having that stuff is will drive us nuts.
Right. Right. And I mean, when it comes to other things that maybe were more positive, like when you think back to the gems that you've discovered, a lot of them will be your selections, but like any stories about like specific sort of like things that came in with a certain writing style or a certain approach that was like it's not necessarily replicatable in terms of like other people doing it, but did anybody bring any sort of creative or otherwise kind of approach to it that kind of made them stand out?
Oh yeah, we've gotten like really clever, like great submissions that either, you know, I wouldn't want to encourage people to toy with the submission form, but sometimes it has worked, you know, like early submissions from like Kyle Reimergarten, who did Fjords, and Natalie Lawhead, and you know, a lot of people that kind of weren't super well known when we got their first submissions, there was obviously like really creative from like the screenshots that we were getting and the way that ways that they were describing their games. Like, I think it's great to be, or at least with a Fantastic Arcade, to be like wild and creative with your game description as long within reason, like as long as it's not like a book link.
So, yeah.
I mean, we got great stuff from the Catamites and, you know, all the people that are kind of like the usual suspects now, but who, you know, 6 years ago or whatever, we weren't as familiar with.
Sure.
Oh gosh, who's the guy who did Love Is Moving? Jason. This is gonna come back to haunt me. We really, really look for people like new folks that haven't been submitting every year and like new takes on all of this. It's been really great at Fantastic Arcade because we build these arcade cabinets to find people that have like already built their own cabinets. Sometimes it's not always practical for us to be able to ship whole built cabinets down, but whenever we can, that's really cool because it makes the arcade look like really different and interesting. The guy that made Love Is Moving was popped into my mind because he built this weird, like whittled wood, giant, like heart shaped arcade cabinet for his game. That was really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. It's, I think it's like, I think it's good for people to hear that like new people who are, who aren't necessarily kind of the well-known folks or the people that are often have their games in these things are something that you guys are looking out for. It's actually as much a strike in their favor as it is against them that you haven't heard of them, because like I think as a curator anyway, and stop me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but there's pleasure in kind of discovering people and elevating people, right?
That's the whole thing, is like finding somebody new and giving them a shot at, you know, exposing people to their work is like, that's the primary joy of doing the thing. Like whenever I talk to people that are like, oh, you know, there's this like indie cabal and you can't get into it and stuff. And it's like, well, there's not a nice way to tell them that, like, you know, the stuff that you're making maybe isn't distinguishing itself to be unique in some way. Like, But yeah, the idea that that people aren't looking for new voices is, I think, completely wrong with all of the curators that I've met. Like that's the main thing is breaking something new.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, terrific. You also select games for Wiggles Rancheros, and that's like kind of more of a kind of like almost like show and tell, right? Or is that, if I got that format wrong?
So the way that Wagos works is historically there's been a game or group of games that get featured each month up on the stage. Like there's a big projector and those games will get played on the projector. But then we also just invite anybody from the Austin community to come show off prototypes of whatever they're building. And that's pretty free for all. Like, you know, we don't want it. We ask that they send us a game to check out first. So we don't get anything that's, you know, wildly offensive in a way that we can't defend. But yeah, that's pretty much a free for all. And it's been pretty successful. A lot of the building up of the community there has been just inviting people to show off their stuff without any real criteria for what, you know, what we think should or shouldn't be played there. And we've gotten a lot of really interesting cross-pollination between developers by doing that, because we have this crowd of folks. There's a little bit of a danger in that it just, you know, that it could just devolve into like just another developer meetup where it like excludes people who aren't developers. But I think because it took us a while to get to that point to where we felt comfortable just inviting anybody to come in and show off their games, that we had enough of an identity and enough of a crowd that we felt safe doing that. I think in the first few years, we probably wouldn't have done that. We would have, because we were trying to assert that this was games in an art context, which is a hard thing to drill into people's heads a lot of the time. at least in Texas.
Sure. Everywhere, more or less, it's a bit of the credibility gap in that respect is real for sure. I think it's a really good, I mean, I know when I see organizations that have things element, like some things that are curated, and that has a certain tone and a certain kind of like space in terms of their programming, alongside of stuff that is more free for all, that is more open access. I think that's a really healthy mix, because it can be really disheartening for people who feel like they're shut out and they will never get in. Like, I think it's necessary to be able to generate, like, as you said, like you basically had it closed until you had established a certain type of culture and a certain kind of tone. Which I think is really totally valid. I mean, you're the people putting in the work to kind of create this a certain type of thing. But that's really cool that you've been able to open it up and it hasn't just all just like it hasn't exploded the membrane of whatever it is you created inside there.
There's a huge danger of being perceived as just being this sort of like cliquish thing, which I think we have suffered from that in the past at times with some folks. So I'm glad we kind of got past that stage. Although like right now, because of all the reorganization, we're not doing the monthly events for a while until we restructure the organization. So who knows what that's going to look like in the future. It's possible that it could go back to a kind of a smaller, more arts focused thing. I really don't know. Stay on as an advisor, but it's kind of up to the Museum of Human Achievement. They've been really good. So I want to tell anybody who's like visited Huegos Rancheros events or Fantastic Arcade in the past, we have a questionnaire, a survey that we're asking people to take to kind of like help from you know, grass seeds up, decide, you know, how to go forward. And if you go to huegosrancheros.com, I think it's linked on there. But that's cool. Super valuable for us.
Great. How long is that survey going on for?
I mean, probably the next few months. So.
Okay. Awesome. Well, that's cool. Yeah. Well, I'm excited to see how things continue to develop and morph in Austin. And thanks so much for taking the time to chat and for all the work you've done, man. You've done super inspiring stuff over the years. It's been really great for me to see, and appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.